Welcome to American Anxiety Attack, your weekly podcast about American history, here to set all your anxieties about not knowing enough about the country's history to rest. This week, we're going to talk a little bit about French history, but don't worry, it's entirely relevant. Remember, if you do enjoy this podcast, please review us on whatever podcatcher you use, and you can also catch us on YouTube, where you can listen to me talking about history while looking at Richard Nixon. I'm not looking at Richard Nixon, you're looking at Richard Nixon, although maybe I am looking at Richard Nixon. You'll never know. In 1789, the French Revolution began. Now, there are clear links to suggest it was influenced by the idea of the American Revolution, that the American Revolution formed a model, or at least an inspiration. Though, of course, it was the French monarchy that had been the colonists' allies during the Revolutionary War. But there are obvious parallels, people overthrowing what was seen as an autocratic and overly powerful monarch. But it'd be wrong to see them as the same story. We could spend an entire podcast series explaining the French Revolution. In fact, there are several excellent podcasts that do just that. One of them is linked in the show notes. But let's go for the very simple summary. The French government was broke. Sounds familiar, right? From fighting wars. Sounds very familiar. From fighting wars in America. This is getting eerie. Notably, it was the support of the colonists during the Revolutionary War that had really put a financial strain on everything. Not to say things were going great before that. In fact, the French monarchy was really, really bad at managing its finances. But this was a key factor in placing pressure on the king to call a gathering of the Estates General. The Estates General is the representative of the French people. It's the old, old form of French government that existed for several centuries, but the king never liked calling them because really, he didn't want to hear from the French people. The calling of the Estates General led to them using this meeting as an opportunity to demand reforms from the government. When the king's government tried to resist, they became more extreme in their demands and their actions, including violence. This eventually led to the king being placed under essentially arrest by the people, and when he tried to flee again, it led to an increased level of radicalism. On one hand, what we have here is a monarchy being turned into a democracy, in one of the oldest nations in Europe, and in the America's most notable ally. This was their brother in the struggle against the British, joining them as a democracy. Jefferson especially was thrilled and thought it was a natural consequence of the American Revolution that gradually all the monarchies of the world would fall. However, by 1792, the revolution's character had changed dramatically. All the neighbouring European nations had declared war on this new French Republic. They didn't want to allow it to inspire similar events in their own countries. The Republic Jefferson had been so excited about was sliding into a series of dictatorships, and the Reign of Terror emerged, as anyone seen as a threat to the revolution had their head cut off, including the king. Generally, the mood in the United States towards the French Revolution responded in time with this. As the great webcomic by Kate and Beaton put it, they found the revolution super creepy. You can find the link to that one also in the show notes. The question of how America would respond became tricky as the French Revolution turned darker and darker. The two political parties would have different responses. The Federalists have an essentially conservative response. Yes, we all like the idea of a republic, but the terror and the disruption and the chaos are bad. We shouldn't be supporting this. We should be encouraging the French to restore order and so on. And you know what encourages order? Monarchies. Meanwhile, Jefferson and the Democratic Republicans initially felt that this was not at all an unreasonable situation. You know, a few noble heads, they were a small price to pay, and they were slow to come out and condemn the situation as that number of heads got into the thousands and often included people who weren't nobles. This created a very easy political attack against Jefferson. He could be associated with the frothing, terrifying French revolutionaries who were just seemingly killing everybody. When Britain joined the war against France, things got even trickier. Britain was still the closest trade party for the United States, and how this was going to affect the North American continent, obviously the British are still in Canada, the French are still west of the Mississippi. If they go back to war, well, they're kind of around America, so what's going to happen there? when faced with the question of if they would support their, technically ally, France, against the British, Washington declared they would remain entirely neutral. They would not slide with either of the combatants. And this was a tricky tightrope he was walking. The Jeffersonian Democratic Republicans thought that despite the revolution's ugliness, that the US should side with France, as a republic, against Britain. And remember, Jefferson is the Secretary of State. On the other hand, Hamilton and the Federalists were of the opinion that maybe the US should side with Britain, purely for financial reasons. This would create a good trade situation where the Americas could be resupplying Britain's war effort, maybe even secure the loans he'd been hoping to get from Britain. From a practical perspective, the US definitely was not in a situation to get caught up in a major European conflict. It lacked the military power to make much of a difference in a war anyway, and was too weak to defend itself if either side attacked them. While technically, this can be seen as a middle road, I think we have to look at this as a victory for Hamilton in many ways. It prevented damage to the US trade relationship with Britain, and Britain knew that the Americans would not contribute to any conflict either. Neutrality left France without any allies, and at the mercy of their enemies. While America was neutral, they still allowed diplomats from both nations access to the country. This lets us talk about the amazing Edmond Genet. Genet is a truly amazing character in the history of the French Revolution. He's a wonderful example of the great survivors. He had served in King Louis's court, developed a hatred of monarchy, which is awkward when you serve in King Louis's court, and when the revolution happened, he was sent to the United States as an ambassador. Now, you'd think, being ambassador, you'd head to Washington, D.C. Instead, Genet sets himself up in Charleston. From here, he recruits American ship captains to serve as privateers, you remember, those legalized pirates, to raid British shipping. He also recruits a mob of locals to march south and attack the Spanish in Florida. As you can imagine, this makes Washington's whole neutrality thing look not so great. So it's not long before Washington is calling for him to be sent packing. This does do even more to sour relations with America and France. In fact, Genet has made such a mess that he knows he'll likely be guillotined back home for failure. So he's actually given asylum in the US and lives out the rest of his days in upstate New York. Such are the odd stories you dig up when looking at this period. In some ways, America's policy of neutrality may have actually been a bonus for France. Had America sided with the French, it would be very easy for the British to blockade trade between the two of them. But a neutral America made this much more tricky. This meant that France could still buy food and other goods from the United States, which they badly needed. None of this means that relations with Britain were going well. There were still several niggling issues that hadn't been resolved. There were still several frontier outposts on the Mississippi that Britain had yet to leave, and were using to sell furs and keep connections to native tribes, which in many cases they could use to harass the French, but obviously it's entirely possible they'd end up harassing the Americans. This did bother America, but they generally tolerated it. But then there's a turning point when Americans take on a group of natives in what is known as the Western Confederacy. After the battle, it became clear that the tribes had been armed with British guns and supplied from the British forts. This led to the natives being forced to sign the Treaty of Grenville, which forced them to stop attacking Americans in the Ohio River Valley and retreat further west. The mistrust that will linger for this will stick around and then boil over in 1812. For the next problem, we have to go as far from inland as possible, onto the high seas. Down in the Caribbean, the British Royal Navy were harassing French shipping, but they also had a tendency of stopping American shipping. And when they did this, there was always the risk of impressment. Now, impressment is the forced recruiting of people into the Navy. This is supposed to happen when you find British sailors sailing on other countries' ships, and you're like, hey, British sailor, you should be serving on a British ship because there's a war on, patriotism, and so on. Instead, what they were often doing was finding American sailors that they could pretend were British, and then using all those guns they've got, convincing that American sailor that he was actually very, very much British and should be serving on a British ship. The Democratic Republicans seized on this as a way to be outraged at Britain and to encourage the US to join with France against them. The Federalists, on the other hand, felt this could be handled diplomatically without risking trade with Britain. In fact, they suggested that a trade embargo or war with Britain could be crippling for the new country, and in hindsight, they were probably right. Washington was certainly opposed to the war, and in 1794 he sent John Jay to London to smooth things over. But in a weird bit of backroom politics that suggested how strongly Hamilton wanted to establish his own friendly ties with Britain, he had already given his contacts in Britain all of Jay's diplomatic negotiating strategy, undermining him before he even arrived. Hamilton was quite happy to see a treaty where Britain was very strong and very happy to trade with the US, and he didn't want Jay going in strong and making trade tricky and pushing Britain around. The result of the Jay Treaty looked bad. It required the folks in the United States who had debts from prior to the revolution owed to British folks. Yeah, the United States government now had to force its own citizens to pay those debts. Also, Britain extra pinky promised to leave its frontier posts, but John Jay had been one of the folks they had told they would do that 20 years earlier, so how reliable do we really think that's going to be? Most topically, Britain said it would pay damages for impressments, but said nothing about stopping future impressments. In fact, if you think about it, if they just set a fee for which they have to pay every time they impressed a sailor, well, that's basically made it okay to impress whoever they want, as long as they can afford to pay the fee. While this avoided war, it was seen by Americans as very embarrassing. John Jay joked that he could, when he came home, he could travel from Boston to Philadelphia at night, lit only by burning effigies of himself. In case you're not familiar, a burning effigy is when you make a dummy of someone and set fire to it just to show how mad you are with them. Jeffersonian Republicans hated it. They saw the debt component as an attack on farmers who might owe for land, while the merchants in the north would be the ones collecting the impressment fees. A year later, the Spanish felt uncomfortable with how close the Jay Treaty was making the US and Britain, and sought its own treaty with the US, so they got the Pinckney Treaty of 1795, which gave Americans the right to travel along the Mississippi River and handed over a disputed section of northern Florida. So what we see here are the European major powers working out how they're going to keep the USA in play, not allow them to become a firm ally of any one power, and pull them between them. Washington could almost certainly have won a third term as president, though there's a good argument that Jefferson might have run against him. However, he decided not to, and there are all sorts of explanations, the most poetic being that he wanted to set a model that presidents should only serve two terms. But he was also getting old and tired, and he didn't want to be in politics as far back as 1789, so it was pretty clear he was done with this whole president gig. His farewell address was fascinating and showed some interesting perspectives on where he saw the country in that moment. He warned Americans against political parties, but that's something of a hollow gesture. The parties existed. He was trying to shut the stable door after that horse had bolted. He saw parties as divisive. Well, yeah, you'd been the de facto leader of one of the parties that created that divide. He also warned against permanent alliances, which is a fun one coming from a man who had broken what was supposed to be the only permanent alliance the Americans had with France. Washington's decrying of political parties didn't stop him throwing his weight behind the Federalists in the upcoming election, but the obvious successor was Hamilton. He had way too many political rivalries at the time and was seen as arrogant and an Anglophile, plus he was not born in the United States, but then technically, neither was Washington, since the United States didn't exist prior to that date, so awkward. So the next obvious candidate was John Adams, who got the nomination in 1796 from the Federalist Party. He would find himself up against Thomas Jefferson. Oof. Now, John Adams is by no means an exciting candidate. Previously, when I would describe John Adams, I'd often equate him to a pasta bar. If there's exciting food options, or pasta, you're not going to choose the bland and uninteresting pasta. But if the other options are all quite unpleasant, then I'll happily take the bland and safe option of a plate of pasta. The Federalists were able to make Jefferson seem such an unstable and radical Francophile, and the Americans were willing to take the safe, bland, stodgy option of John Adams, history's pasta bar. Not that it wasn't close, he won 71-68. This, of course, made Jefferson the clear runner-up, which weirdly, under the original terms, meant he became the vice president. This is clearly a terrible idea. Adams was already seen as quite weak, but also had then had the dynamic and popular Jefferson as his vice president. And he also had the spectre of Hamilton looming in the background, who thought Adams wasn't Federalist enough for the presidency. So he had people on both sides who looked a lot more exciting than him. To make this all more complex, the situation with France was only getting worse. France was still angry over both the Neutrality Proclamation, which they saw as breaking their treaty, and the Jay Treaty, which they saw as siding with Britain. Because of this, French warships started raiding American ships in the Caribbean. In practical terms, an unofficial war, or what we know as the Quasi-War, broke out. It just hadn't been declared. Many Americans were outraged and felt they might as well go to war with France. Adams sent delegates to France to try and solve this situation, and it would lead to another of the great political scandals, the XYZ Affair. Okay, strap in. We're going to meet another great French political survivor, the French Foreign Minister, Talleyrand. I love Talleyrand. He's amazing. He was a former French noble, before being a noble dramatically increased your chance of getting your head cut off, and a bishop, before being a bishop, well, it dramatically increased the chance of you getting your head cut off. He was able to ride the wave of revolution, throwing his titles away just in time to become the minister in the revolutionary government. Specifically this time, he's the foreign minister, and he was, to put it mildly, comically corrupt. American delegates were officially rejected by France. Terribly sorry, you can't meet Monsieur Talleyrand, he's very busy. But then, three different French officials, all known associates of Talleyrand, informally suggested to the American delegates that if they, perhaps wanted to drop a bit of cash into Talleyrand's pocket and maybe float a loan to the cash-strapped French government, and maybe then Talleyrand would be very happy to meet them. In the official write-up of this sent to Congress, these associates were codenamed X, Y, and Z to protect their identities before the American delegates got home and could finally let the news out. The delegates said, yeah, we'll let you know. Then they left the country as fast as they could. When the American people heard about this, they were absolutely outraged. In fact, because he announced millions for defence, not one penny in tribute, suddenly John Adams was popular. He was exciting. This is a spicy pasta bar suddenly. American ships started capturing French ships. The quasi-war was on. France actually backed down a bit. There was no way they were going to go to war with America officially. Talleyrand presumably realised he'd gone too far, and he agreed to meet with any new delegates Adams might like to send him. Thank you very much. Adams took the smart move, possibly at the expense of his own glory, and sent the delegates to de-escalate the situation. The spice was gone. We're back to the blandest of pasta. These delegates get to Paris and create the Convention of 1800. This formally recognised the US-French alliance was over, and the Americans would pay for damages to French shipping, the French would pay for damages to American shipping, and everybody would just calm down. It's highly possible that had Adams decided to go to war, he could have won re-election in 1800. But the peace route was not going to get him there. By 1800, the Americans had remembered everything they didn't like about him, and he was never going to defeat Thomas Jefferson again. But it's likely the best thing for America at the time. Despite the anti-French sentiment, the nation was just not in a position to fight a war. The Federalists were not going to pass up a chance to keep the anti-French mood, though, and use it to their advantage. You get a couple laws passed at this time that need looking at. The first is the Alien Law. It made it tougher for immigrants to come into the United States and become citizens. The pretense is this will protect Americans from foreigners who might be coming in to undermine the nation, by which we mean probably French people at the time. The residency requirement for citizenship goes from 5 years to 14 years. This is a strong change from the previous position, where immigration would be seen as very easy. The president also gained the personal authority to deport any foreigners at will. But beneath this, the Federalists already knew that immigrants were much more likely to vote for the Democratic Republicans. So by delaying immigrant citizenship, they could buy themselves some time. Yep, this isn't a new political idea, folks, if this sounds at all familiar. The second part is the Sedition Act, and this limited speech or writing that was critical of the government. This is a hilarious thing for the United States to push, since it had been one of the big complaints for some of the actions of the British prior to the Revolution. Sedition is a powerful word. In this case, it covered anyone criticising the government in any way that was counteractive to the public good. But of course, the government would be the ones deciding what counted as counteractive to the public good. Its stated purpose was to prevent foreigners, like maybe the French, from stirring up trouble in the United States. But its clear goal and use was to silence enemies of the Federalists and John Adams personally. If this seems like a direct conflict with the First Amendment, that's because, you know, it is. Many newspaper editors found themselves in jail for criticizing the law itself. The most noteworthy example was an editor called Matthew Lyon, who criticized President Adams in his paper. The criticisms were seen as quite mild compared to the political discourse of today. Specifically, they said he was, you know, short, bald, overweight, and uninteresting and a bit bumbling, which, you know, in hindsight, he was. These laws were passed by a Federalist-dominated Congress, signed by a Federalist president, and upheld by a Federalist-appointed Supreme Court. The sedition laws had even been set to expire in 1801 in case the Federalists lost re-election, because they didn't want them used against them if the Democratic Republicans seized a presidency in the House. In response to the Alien and Sedition laws, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison got the state legislatures of Virginia and Kentucky to pass bills condemning them that, you know, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison had written. In simple terms, these resolutions said the federal government had overstepped their constitutional authority when they passed these acts. This rested on the compact theory, that the Constitution had been a compact, an agreement, entered into by the original 13 states. They had made the federal government, so if the federal government made laws that states didn't approve of, they could be nullified by the states, who were in the end more powerful because they created the federal government. Does this sound circular yet? If it sounds like awkward logic, it rests on the theory that fundamentally the states are the creator of the federal government and thus retain the power to veto or ignore actions it makes. This theory is known more commonly as nullification, and the idea is if one state says they will not allow the, say, Alien and Sedition Act to be enforced in their boundaries, then other states will follow suit, effectively nullifying the law. The Federalist argument was quite clever. It said no, the states did not create the federal government. The people created the federal government. The states were just the vehicle by which they did that. It's we the people, not we the states. Thus, the states could not override federal laws. Keep thinking about that one. When we get to the 1830s, we're going to hear this again, and then, my goodness, we're going to hear it in the 1850s and 1860s. On that note, we can wrap it up there, looking down the barrel of Jefferson's win in 1800. That will be known by his allies as the Revolution of 1800, and it will be a big deal in how the nation functions for the next few decades. Thank you.